So first, I'd like to thank you, Mike and Eileen and Boris for organizing this. This has been a great week for me, talking to all these people here and enjoying the interactions during the talks and after the talks. And especially during the talks. So we'll see how it goes from here. We'll also talk about interactions, intercellular interactions. And basically, we looked at already quite a few developmental patterning processes during this workshop. And we have discussed how remarkably reproducible these developmental patterns are. And as we know, over the past couple of decades, we gained a lot of information about the components that underlie these patterns, creating these detailed genetic circuits, compiling genes, proteins, signaling molecules, and so on. And the striking thing is that even though we know a lot about these detailed genetic circuits, okay, we often do not understand how they actually produce the underlying patterns, okay? And even if we do understand, we often do not understand why a certain circuit is chosen, if you want, by evolution over an alternative circuit that may produce or may do the same function. The other aspect that I'm going to try to talk about is how specific components within these circuits are actually optimized to work in an integrated circuit. And I'm talking about the signaling pathway, the non-signaling pathway that I'll describe later. Okay, so I'm going to try to address some of these questions in the context of one class of patterning processes that I call fine-grained developmental patterns. These are patterns in which neighboring cells adopt different fates. Okay, and here are two examples. Okay, the first example on the left is the developing inner ear of a chick. In this case, it's actually very similar to our own inner ear. And what you see here is a kind of a checkerboard-like pattern of cells where the white cells are going to be the hair cells, the sensory hair cells, and the dark cells around them are going to develop into the supporting cells that surround each hair cell. Now, this kind of pattern arises from a process which is called lateral inhibition that I hope to have a chance to get to today. Basically, the remarkable thing here, right, is that this pattern takes an initially uniform field of cells, right, and breaks the symmetry between them so that you get this kind of a checkerboard-like pattern. Now, the other example is the delineation of shower boundaries. And the example that I'm bringing here is the example of these wing veins in the wing of Drosophila. And again, in this situation, you ask the question, and Michael asked in the beginning, how do you get a situation where one cell on one side of the boundary adopt one fate, and right next to it, the other cell adopt a different fate? Right. The nice thing about, the interesting thing about these two examples is that they both use the same, or in both cases, the same signaling pathway is being used, and that's the notch signaling pathway, which is maybe the canonical signaling system between neighboring cells. So it's a direct cell-cell signaling pathway. Okay, what I'm going to talk to you about today is how the notch signaling pathway is optimized for the generation of such pattern. And in fact, what I will argue is that the notch signaling pathway does not merely transfer information between neighboring cells. In fact, it takes an active role in generating a distinction between neighboring cells. Okay. All right, so a little bit about the notch pathway. The notch gene was identified by Thomas Hunt Morgan almost 100 years ago. This is a picture from his famous book, The Theory of the Gene. And the mutant here, which, okay, is that it creates notches on the wing of the fly. Okay, Interestingly, Notch is actually involved in many other processes in the fly, in fact, in all the vertebrates, in all metazoans. It involves in generating this kind of bristle patterning, segmentation of the leg, the compound eye, which Nick will surely talk about, antenna, and so on. Okay, it's highly conserved across metazoans. Flies have, we'll talk about the mechanism. Basically, how does the notch signaling pathway, notch signaling is transduced? Notch encodes a single transmembrane receptor, which can interact with a single transmembrane ligand called delta. In fact, flies have two ligands, delta and jagged, and humans have five ligands, four notches. Now, this interaction leads to a series of events in which the intracellular domain of notch is cleaved and then goes to the nucleus and activates downstream targets. It forms an activation complex. Now, interestingly, there's also another interaction between notch and delta, and that interaction between is interaction between notch and delta in the same cell. And in fact, this kind of interaction leads to inhibition of signaling rather than activation. So this is called cis inhibition and has been observed in several contexts, developmental contexts. Okay, so this is cis inhibition as opposed to transactivation, and I'll use these two words again and again during this talk. Okay, so the question that I'm asking, or I was asking about the system, is the following: how does the notch signaling pathway integrates these two inputs? Okay, given a cell that expresses notch receptors, okay, how does the how is it affected by delta from neighboring cells, the trans delta, and by delta from the same cell, the cis delta, and how does it the output, which is the expression of downstream targets, depend on these two inputs? Okay, what is the functional form? And maybe more importantly is, why do we actually need these two activities of delta? Why do we need this cis interaction on top of the trans interaction between between a notch and delta? Okay, so basically, the way I decided to attack this issue is to try to build a sort of a synthetic cell culture system that would allow me to measure this function, okay, this input-output relation. And so the idea is to take mammalian cells that do not usually express a notch or its ligands. Stably transfect them with receptors and ligands, and you'll see them in a minute, the construct. And with fluorescent protein reporters, we use time-lapse microscopy to track the dynamics of signaling for different levels of ligands. And finally, we use mathematical models both to analyze our results and to try to understand how the properties of notch signaling that we measure actually affect developmental patterning processes like boundary formation or lateral inhibition. Okay, so here is the sort of experimental setup. So we wanted to have a setup that would allow us to measure the notch signaling response to both cis and trans delta. Okay, so we take, we start with this cell line CHOK1, it's a standard mammalian cell line. It does not express a notch receptors. We stably transfect into it a variant of notch in which we replace the intracellular domain of notch with a synthetic activator, okay, called Gal4. Okay, why do we do that? Basically, we want to avoid, at least in the initial state, to avoid activation of any endogenous genes that may create some sort of feedback. We also do the same experiment that I'm going to describe to you with full-length notch one. Basically, the results are the same. Okay, we have a fluorescent reporter that reads out the synthetic activator. Now, to control for cis delta, we take delta-like one, which is a mammalian variant of delta, mammalian homolog of delta, and we fuse it to a red fluorescent protein, and we put it under an inducible promoter. That means we can induce the level of cis-delta two different levels through addition of small molecule docks to the media. Okay, to control for trans-delta, we take essentially the delta protein, the external part of the delta protein, and we adsorb it to the plate at different concentrations. Okay, so this way we can control both cis and trans-delta independently and read out the notch signaling response. Okay, so let's look first at a movie that we make from this cell line, and we initially do not induce any cis delta. We just ask, okay, how does the notch signaling responds to trans delta? Okay, so there's delta on the plate here. These are cells that are plated on glass. There's delta that is absorbed to a plate at a certain concentration. The other thing that we do here is that we add an inhibitor of notch signaling called the APT. We add it to the media, and then at the beginning of the movie, we remove the inhibitor, allow the interaction, and we can watch what happens as the interaction occurs. So this is like turning on the interaction. So let's look at how it looks. Okay, so the cells sort of move, grow, and divide. And as the time progresses, we see that our reporter turns on. Okay, our reporter is fused to a histone 2B, so it's nuclear localized, which helps us a lot in segmentation image analysis of the system. Okay, so, yeah. The inhibitor inhibits the gamma secretase, which is the enzyme that cleaves the intracellular domain of notch. So, yeah, that's it. They can still interact, okay? And in fact, they might even there might be some cleavage. There's actually two cleavage processes that occur there. It's S2 and S3. So we're only inhibiting S3. So there could be some sort of a transient effect in the beginning. Okay, we look over extended time, so we sort of average over the initial transient response. Right, this is about 48 hours. Okay. Okay, so now we want to analyze this movie, but maybe before we analyze the movie, let us think for a second, what do we actually expect to see, okay? So one can think about sort of two extreme limits for the response to trans-delta. Okay, one extreme limit would be on what we call the graded response on the left. Maybe notch signaling response should be proportional to delta, right, up to some point where it saturates. Okay, the reason that you might think that this is the case is because we know that a single delta binds to a single notch generating a single intracellular domain. Okay, so it's a seems to be at least a sort of a linear process. Okay, on the other hand, you might think that maybe the notch signaling response is a very nonlinear switch-like behavior of delta, and the reason that you might think that this is the case is because we know that notch signaling is involved in cell fate decision, right? And you might want to say, okay, maybe you would have the switch already in the notch signaling pathway, right? And the way we characterize our setup is that we fit our data to a Hill function, and we look at basically the Hill coefficient, which describes how sensitive the output is compared to the input. Okay, so this is a film strip from the movie, and basically what we do now, we segment all the tracks Okay, we identify the fluorescence of each of the cells. We look at the total fluorescence per cell. And we can either track single cells and look what happens to them, or we can look at sort of the median, or the, in this case, we look at the median fluorescence per frame. Okay, and this is what you see. The first curve here is the notch signaling response that you see here in this movie. Okay, so after some initial slowdown, it sort of turns on, as you've seen from the movie. And if you can now repeat the same movie for different concentration of plate-bound delta, okay, and get these plots. Right? So each point here basically corresponds to one frame or a few hundred cells. Okay. Okay. So now we want to sort of extract the sort of input-output relation. Now the output of a signaling system is essentially how many reporters are produced per unit time. So we would like to look at the slope of this line as a function of plate-bound delta. Yes?
So the curve comes from an average of about 100 cells a second? Because when I look at the pictures individually, it seems that each cell might actually have a more switch-like behavior while the average comes on more slowly. So would this look very different if you...
Right. So. Yeah, so we also do the same thing with the same thing. Where is it? Okay. So we also do the same thing with co-culture. Basically we can take two types of cells. Okay, one that expresses delta and one that expresses a notch and a reporter. Okay, these two things. And we can look at the single cell. And in fact, we can follow single cells and ask whether they turn on sharply. And the data that I'm presenting here shows you that they're pretty linear. Okay. In fact,
I'm a little surprised that it's non-linear since you have clustered Gallop-4 binding sites in the Gallop-4 activator.
Right. So we actually measured the Gallop-4 response, and we do not see a non-linear activation of the Gallop-4 response. To your question, we basically also track single cells, okay, and we can look at the how the slopes of single cell slopes change as a function of plate bound delta, right? And basically, we see the same linear response. Okay.
But that was with the standard arrangements of the UAS sites.
Yes.
Well,
yeah. Okay, I can show the data later. I mean, we do get a... Right, so, okay, so this is showing the slope of each of these curves as a function of plate-bound delta, and we get a fit that would give you somewhere between 1 and 2, okay, which we cannot tell whether it's 1 or 2, but we take that to say that it doesn't have a very high cooperative response. Okay.
Before you read this slide, can you tell us about the units of plate-bound delta?
Yes, good. We do not have an exact calibration of, okay, the way the experiment works is that we take a known concentration of diffusible or essentially soluble delta, Okay, we adsorb it to the plate. Okay, and the way we adsorb it to the plate is that we essentially incubate it with the plate under certain conditions for a certain time. Okay, and a certain amount of that is adsorbed to the plate. So we cannot calibrate that in terms of absolute concentration of delta, but what we can, and what we did, was to make sure that we are in the linear regime. Okay, so that basically we, using sort of an ELISA assay, we check whether the amount of that is bound on the surface is proportional to the concentration that we use. And in fact, it's slightly nonlinear. You get at the end, at our high end, you get a little bit of saturated regime, but we can compensate for that. So this is what we call the calibrated B plate. Yeah.
Can you comment on whether you think delta is a monomeric ligand and what difference that makes? So because if delta is multimeric, the amount of active ligand on your sort of plate is not linear concentration.
Well, it would still no, it would still be linear with the concentration, right? It would just be dimers
so
of delta.
Are like randomly there in that same
well. I have a certain concentration of delta. Okay, if they tend to, if they're monomer, they would bind at a certain concentration of my monomer. If they're dimers, they would form dimers and they would bind at a certain.
What if they're monomers and the receptor needs to bind to them?
Okay, we don't have evidence for that, I think, I don't know. Okay, we don't see a big difference whether. We look at plate-bound delta or at delta that in cells that are co-cultured.
Wait, does your ELISA assay have a quantification?
No, it's just antibody staining, basically.
So you don't, there's no quantification, antibody quantification
to increase. No, it's a fluorescently labeled antibody, and. There's some amplification, I guess, because of we use a you could have several secondary antibodies bind to the IgG that is attached to plate bound delta, right? But you still would expect to have a linear response there. Yeah. All right. Okay, so that was the response to. Trans delta. Now we wanted to look at the response to cis delta, and here we basically used an experimental trick, which is the following. Prior to the beginning of the movie, we induced the cells with doxycycline to express high levels of cis delta, and then as we start the movie, we wash out the inducer. So we no longer produce any new delta, and we allow delta to slowly dilute as a function of time, okay, as the cells grow and divide. So basically, this is a way for us to slowly scan the level of cis delta in the cells as a function of time, and we can go to any time point and ask, okay, what is the cis delta level here, and what's the notch signaling response at that level?
What fraction of the induced delta?
No, we do not detect any endogenous delta. Okay. There's another question, which is interesting, is what fraction of the induced delta is actually on the surface, right? And we do not know the answer to that. And we take the assumption, simplifying assumption, that the fraction on the surface, fraction on the surface is proportional to the total level of delta in the cells. Okay, you will see in a second. It's actually an important point, right? So what you want to, when you want to do this experiment, you want to avoid delta from one cell activating notch in a neighboring cell, right? You want to treat it as if delta, the only thing delta does is cis inhibits notch in the same cell. Right, as you'll see in the beginning of the movie, cells are pretty far apart. in the end of the movie, they start to be more touching, but you have very little delta at that point. And we have a control, basically, that asks, okay, do we see any activation? Okay, if we don't put any plate-bound delta in, you'll see that.
But we're still delta in, on the plate, right?
Yeah, so the experiment is as follows. Okay, we take these cells. Again, we plate them at some on some plate-bound delta with a given concentration. And they initially express high levels of cis delta, which is shown here in red fluorescence, right, since our delta is used to enter. Okay, so let's start the movie and see. We remove the daft as before. Okay, and you can see that the cells grow and divide. And as they grow and divide, you see the level of cis delta slowly goes down. And then at some point, you see the notch signaling reporter turns on. Okay. Good. Okay, so again, we can analyze this movie. And again, this is a population average measurement, and I'll show in a minute a few single cell measurement. And what you see here is the following. We look at the average delta M cherry in the cells, okay, and we look at the notch signaling response per cell, or the notch reporter per cell. And what you see is that for quite a long time, there's no response. And then after a certain time, you get a sharp turn on of the response as a function of. That's right. So this is done again with varying concentrations of trans delta. In this case, the maximal concentration. Okay, and what I want to point out about this is that if you look at the decay time of delta M cherry, it's as you see, it's decays over a pretty long time scale. Okay, which corresponds to the lifetime of or the cell division rate of these cells. Okay, but if you look at the time it takes for the notch signaling response to turn on, it's much shorter than the decay time of delta M cherry. Okay, just me to say, so the response, the change in response from almost from zero slope to, let's say, maximal slope takes a lot less time than the typical decay time of delta M cherry. Yep. Yes. Right. So the idea is that these cells express notch, which can be activated by trans delta and inhibited by cis delta. Okay. Good. So it seems like cis delta exhibits a very sharp response, but this is a population average measurement. Alex, you mentioned, okay, maybe it looks much sharper at the single cell level. And in fact, when we look at the single cell level, so we can track single cells, what's shown here are two cells. Okay, what's shown here are two cells. The red is the M cherry. There are these cell division drops that occur, right? And you can see them, the fluorescence is essentially halved at each cell division. Okay, and what you see is that if you look at single cells, right, you get this extremely sharp turn on. So just to analyze it, what we do is sort of shift the fluorescence every time there's a cell division so that we get a sort of a continuous line, right, and we can plot it here, and then we can ask, okay, how fast does it take this cell to rise from almost no response to maximal response, okay? And the typical rise time is, as you see here, is just a few hours, right? Now, what does it mean? It basically means, okay, so if we now look at one of these cells, right, and we plot the mean M cherry and slowly decays, right, and very sharp response, we can fit this to a decaying exponent and to a turn on function that basically would tell us how sharp this is, right? We get basically a Hill coefficient of about 22 plus minus 10. That's a 95% confidence interval for this cell. And we can do the same thing, right, for many cells, and we get an effective cooperativity of or effective Hill coefficient of about 12. It's just the shifting is just to allows us to do the fit to one function. That's all. Yeah. Okay. So basically, what we do, right? We go to where there's a cell division, right? And we shift curve by a factor of 2 from that point on, right? So it keeps the same slope, right? So it just, since what we're only interested is on the slope of the line, right, then we don't care on any drops due to cell division. Okay. Oh, so that's the question, right? How do I understand this sharp response, right? And especially in light of the fact that when we measure the response to trans delta, we got a pretty graded response, right? So if you think about it, it cannot be some effect of, let's say, downstream cooperativity of the UAS promoter, right, or anything like that, because you would see that both in trans and in cis, right? So how do you get this kind of marked difference between these two processes? And in a couple of slides, I will bring out the model that we have. Okay, now we can do the same thing for, we can essentially run the same movie that you saw now for different levels of trans delta to obtain the sort of full two-dimensional signaling response to both cis and trans delta. And basically, this is shown here. We look at the fluorescence as a function of time and as a function of trans delta. Time here corresponds to the decay in cis delta, which we've seen before. And the first curve here, right, is just the movie that I just showed you, right? This sharp turn with respect to cis delta. Now, we repeat the same movie. We do duplicates of each movie, and then we change the trans delta. And basically, you see that in all these response curves, there's this sharp switch-like turn on with respect to cis delta. Okay, but if you look at the slopes, let's see, if you look at the slopes at how they change, right, they change pretty linearly, pretty gradually. Right, so again, you see this two different behaviors, right? The graded response with respect to trans delta and the sharp response with respect to cis delta. Okay? Now, there's another interesting feature here, which is the following. If you look at the turn-on point, what level of cis delta does notch signaling response turns on, what you see is that they appear to be independent of the level of trans delta. Okay? Now, this is was also a little bit surprise for us because of the following, right? If you think of a model that has a competition between cis and trans delta, okay, so there's you have notch receptors that there's a competition between to binding of two notch between cis and trans delta. If you now in this model, if you would reduce the level of cis delta, you would expect that you would need less trans delta to actually activate, right? So you would not expect this kind of independence of the response on cis delta. No, this is a population averages. So each one of these curves corresponds to one movie. Each point corresponds to one frame of the movie. Okay?
You have what, 10 cells?
No, I have like 100 or so. Okay.
So
It's not simply a competitive inhibitor, okay? I would say. Okay.
Maybe this is a why question, but I would have just thought that the transdelta interaction would have been the one that should be more switch-like, just based on, typically that's what's causing the labyrinth inhibition,
right?
Of the self-fate choice.
So right. Good. That's a good question, right? When we started this work, right, we were expecting to see some sort of a switch-like behavior in the trance, okay? And the fact is that we do not see that. You could imagine that the switch-like behavior occurs downstream of the signaling itself, right? So let's say whatever promoter, okay, whatever feedbacks that you have in the system and so on, okay? Right. That's right. I do not have. Right. That's right. And I don't get lateral inhibition in this system, right? That's. Yeah. No, okay. What I will do later, okay, I will essentially ask, given a lateral inhibition circuit, right, how does it changes when you add the cis interaction? Okay? All right, so how do you explain this kind of sharp switch-like behavior and this disparate response to both cis and trans delta? And basically, we came up with a relatively simple model that accounts for those observations. And the basic interaction that we consider in our model is the following. We assume that notch and cis delta in the same cell, can bind each other and form an inactive complex, okay? And that this inactive complex actually makes both notch and delta inactive in a stoichiometric manner, okay? Yes. Right. So. Well, one thing. Let me try to understand what you're asking. Do you ask whether if I change notch level, right, does it affect the ability of delta to? You mean the expression of cis delta? Sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, I mean, having a cis notch delta complex is like reducing the non-readable notch for concentration.
Right.
Okay. So if the two notches, cis delta, is not related by notch, changing the level of cis, the level of delta, is like reducing the level of delta.
Yeah, that's effectively what we say. Okay, that's effectively what we say, and we also show that. Okay? Good. All right. So this is a sort of our main assumption in the model, this kind of stoichiometric inhibition. The other interaction that we have in our model is that when notch can bind to trans delta, and that binding to trans delta, delta in the neighboring cell can generate the signal, which in our case is just the intracellular domain of notch. So basically, what we get is a kind of a simple, we can write a sort of a simple set of dynamical equations that describe the interactions that we have in our system. We have slightly simplified this by assuming that the binding to the complex is irreversible, so it makes it a little bit easier, but it's not a necessary requirement. Okay, so basically we can describe our system by three main variables, free notch, free delta, and the signal. Okay, and what we have here is basically we have production rates of notch and delta, that are assumed to be constant. We have linear degradation rates of notch delta and the signal. And then we have the mutual inactivation term, which essentially is a kind of a nonlinear term, which says that if free notch binds to free delta, they're both out of the system, right? Finally, we have an interaction between notch and trans delta, in this case, the plate-bound delta, and that generates the signal. Okay, and so it's a very simple set of equations. Okay, there is no specific nonlinearity or cooperativity that I introduced into these sets of equations, but nevertheless, if I now simulate my experiments, right, in fact, I can see that I can get, for a very broad range of parameters, a sharp response with respect to cis delta and a very graded response with respect to trans delta. Okay? There are, I think, three or four parameters that are involved. Okay? Well, you can see it here, right? You can actually get rid of some of the parameters by a normalization, right? So basically, you would have normalized production, you would have the cis interaction, you would have the trans interaction. Okay? Which parameters? Production.
Yeah.
Okay, cis delta, or the cis strength of cis interaction, and the strength of trans interaction. Okay. But what gives rise to this sharp switch-like behavior? And to understand that, let's consider the steady state of the equations that I just showed you, and we can ask how much free notch and free delta do these cells have, okay? And for as a parameter that we change, okay, well, let's change the production rate of delta, okay, and ask for each production rate, what is the amount of free notch and free delta? So this is exactly the sort of sequestration that you asked about. Okay, so this is what's shown here. Basically, we vary the production rate of delta, and we fix the production rate of notch. And what you see is that there's actually two regimes in this graph. Okay, one regime on the left side, when delta production rate is below the notch production rate. This is a situation where you have more notch than delta in the cell. And in that situation, right, most of the delta is bound in these inactive complexes, and you have excess of free notch. Okay, so this cell, even though it expresses both notch and delta, can receive signal but cannot send it. Okay. On the other hand, if you in the other regime where you are in the you have higher production rate of delta than notch, then you have more delta than notch in the cell. The notch is almost all of the notch is bound in this inactive complex, and you have excess of free delta. So basically, in this case, this cell can send but cannot receive. So what it means is the following. It means that this kind of cis interaction, okay, or the mutual inactivation between notch and delta, essentially forces the cell into one of two modes, or one of two states. Okay, your cell can be either a sender, okay, or a receiver, but not both. Okay, and of course, the factor that affect how sharp the switch-like behavior is basically the strength of cis interaction in the system. Okay. Now I want to point out that this is kind of right. So you're asking, do we have evidence for inhibiting of delta by notch, right? Yes, in fact, we do. I'll show it in a second. Okay, so basically, what we're saying is that this cis interaction is an inherent property of the notch delta signaling system, and it essentially forces the cells into this switch-like behavior. This is, and this, as you'll see later in the talk, it's essentially going to be very important for self-fate decision-making processes during pattern formation. At least, yep. Right, so I'm going to talk about an exact example like this, okay?
And does this model capture some of the sort of classic genetic studies done by Patricia Simpson to show there's just a very subtle difference in the gene dosage of
the recombinant? Right, yeah, it does, and it's something that I will get to in a few slides, exactly. All right, so... okay, so to your question, Alex. So one of the main predictions of this model is indeed to say, okay, it's not only delta inhibiting notch, but it's also notch inhibiting delta, right? And we did an experiment where we took a co-culture of cells expressing notch, okay, and a reporter, and we co-cultured them either with cells expressing delta or with cells expressing notch and delta. And the expectation is that notch, the cells expressing both notch and delta, would be less efficient in activating the notch reporter cells. And this is what we see when we grow cells that have only delta. You can see that there are more reporter cells activated than cells that are expressing both notch and delta. Okay. Interestingly, this kind of cis inhibition is not observed only in notch delta signaling system, but has been recently observed in other cell-to-cell signaling systems like the semaphorins and efferents. It would be interesting to see if similar observations to the ones that we discuss here are also observed in that system. And in fact, I think there are some indications for that. Both of these systems, by the way, are used for totally different purpose. They're used in axon guidance during neural development, and they're axon guidance cues. For guiding the axons to the right location. Okay, so far I talked about what happens if you think about a single cell picture, right? If you have a single cell, you know, you're either sender or receiver. But how does this picture change us when we consider two cells? Okay, so let's think for a second what happens if we take two cells that are relatively similar to each other, okay? However, one has slightly more delta than notch on the right-hand side, and the other one has slightly less delta than notch on the left-hand side. Right? And what we see is that this kind of property, this mutual inactivation, will essentially create a strong signaling bias from the right cell to the left cell, from the sender to the receiver. And it's a small difference. This kind of mechanism can take a small difference between the cells and amplify, and the output can be amplified into a large difference, or reduces it to a large difference between the output of the two signals. Okay, questions so far? Yep. Right.
And if it's enough notch, then it's above the threshold. And as Thomas said, it's just as though you had like a lower amount of notch in the signal. But when you have cells interacting with one another, so you didn't really talk about the transition zone between the two.
Okay, so this is
that's really what's important.
The transition from, let's say,
very close to the boundary between them.
Right.
That's what's really important.
Okay, so this is related to what I'm going to talk about next. Okay. What we can now ask, okay, given the presence of cis interactions between cells, how does it affect patterning processes like boundary formation and lateral inhibition? Okay? And you know, the kind of analysis that we can do is to ask whether mechanisms that are based on this mutual inactivation or the cis inhibition perform better in some metric, right, than mechanisms without it. So for example, if we consider lateral inhibition, we can ask how does lateral inhibition performs with cis inhibition compared to a model without it. Yeah. Yeah, it has to be. For lateral inhibition, it has to be this way. That's right. That's right. Okay. But let me first consider the case for boundary formation. The system that we looked at is the wing vein boundary. And I'll say a few things about the system. So what's known about the formation of the wing vein is that notch signaling is involved in defining the boundaries of the wing, okay? So if you look at a notch signaling reporter enhancer split in the developing wing imaginal disk, you get these two sharply defined sidebands of expression, okay, defining the sides of the vein. I want to point out that the position of the vein is not determined by notch signaling. It's predetermined, some sort of pre-patterning that is determined by other morphogen gradients involved in this system. Okay, and the other thing that is known about the system is that there's a morphogen that is veinless that is emitted from the center of the vein and essentially decays away from the center of the vein, right? And you can ask, okay, given this observation, what can we say about this kind of process? And the idea is the following. Okay, let's say you have some sort of a gradient of production of delta that is controlled by a morphogen. And at least initially, we assume that notch is pretty constant in the system. Okay, what we expect is that we would have these two regimes that we already seen. Yeah. Right. Yeah, so these two lines, so if you look from the top, right, you can see the expression of a target gene of delta. Okay. It's not a tube, no, it's a structural vein. It doesn't transfer any blood or anything. These are cells that have different mechanical features than the cells surrounding them. There's actually veins. Okay, the wing imaginal disk is a kind of a balloon that sort of grows up. Okay, and you would have the two sides that form veins on both the dorsal and the ventral side, and these two patterns of veins then come together to form the final structural vein in the system. It's pretty flat pattern. It's slightly, it forms a slightly a bump if you. Opposite one, right. That's right. Okay. The what? The fact that it's dark?
Two dark stripes could just be that it's a cube. So you're looking at more cells in the
okay. Right. This is RNA thing. Right. Okay. So going back to our very simple model for this, okay, we have a graded production of delta from the center of the vein outward. We assume that notch is pretty constant, okay, and then we ask, okay, what does our model tell us? Basically, it tells us the following, okay. If you're here at the center of the vein, you have more delta than notch, okay, so these cells are ascenders. And if you're here on the sort of flanking side, you have more notch than delta, then these cells are receivers, right? So if we plot the free delta and free notch, these are the profiles. You have a lot of free notch here, very little free delta, a lot of free delta, and very little free notch at the center, okay? But what does it mean in terms of signaling, right? You don't expect much signaling here because there's hardly any free delta. You don't expect much signal here because there's hardly any free notch. Okay, but you do expect signaling right at the crossing point between these, right? You expect that free delta on one side of the boundary would activate notch on the other side of the boundary, right? So if you look at the signaling response in such a model, you would get two sharply defined side bed of expression, which is what is observed.
Okay. The position is fixed by something.
Right. So the position, as you see in a second, right, it depends. It depends on the crossing point. It's fixed by some pre-pattern in the system. Yeah. Yeah, so that's exactly it, right? So right, so that depends. First of all, it depends on the relative level of notch and delta, right? So you would expect that if you change the relative level of notch and delta, you would change the pattern, right? Right, so that's exactly right. The activity of notch here is very strictly defined to just a few rows of cells. Okay, it does not depend very strongly on the properties of the boundary and so of the properties of the gradient, right? So somehow these two lines, the way we imagine it, they restrict the vein from expanding further. Okay. So there are other instructive signal here at the center of the vein that would tell these cells to differentiate into vein cells. All right. So there's actually, as is usual, in development, you would want to look at different mutants and say, okay, can we explain based on our model some unexplained or some different mutant phenotype. And there's actually a very curious mutant behavior in this system. And basically, a long time ago, it has been observed that if you look at heterozygous mutants of notch and heterozygous mutants of delta, okay, you get vein phenotype. Okay, and in fact, if you look at heterozygous mutant of notch, so a single copy of notch, you get these broader veins, veins that are broad but are still sharply defined. And if you look at the heterozygous mutant of delta, you get these veins that are quite broad but are kind of diffuse and not very well defined. Okay, and interestingly, if you look at the double heterozygous mutant of notch, okay, it regains the wild type. Okay. Now, if you think about simple, let's say, picture of transactivation of notch, that is not what you would expect, right? Because you say, if I reduce the level of delta by a factor of 2, I have less signal. It generates some... What? We didn't put it in. I just put it here for illustration. Sorry, no. The pictures here are for illustrations. The mutant phenotypes are shown in the picture, and I took the wild type from somewhere else. Okay, because they just don't show it. All right. Cause what? Well, unfortunately, we do not do the fly experiments, but the what?
That
I think people have looked. I think that's the point, that if you look at the double heterozygous of mutant, okay, that's what the claim is, okay, in the paper. Do you have?
This is the image of wild type, or this is the image of the double heterozygous?
No, well, it's the image of the wild type. Okay. I apologize for that. Oh, Nick, do you have something to say about the double heterozygous? I couldn't find the picture of the double heterozygous mutant. Right. The data that they do in this paper of the cells and brain, they basically they measure the width for a different copy number of notch, okay, and it basically is broader in the notch heterozygous mutant, okay. Okay. So the point that I want to make here, again, this is for illustration. I presented it this way, and the point that I would like to make, that if you think only about trans activation, right, you would not expect this kind of compensation, right, dosage compensation, because you would say, if I reduce the level of delta by a factor of 2, then I would expect less signal, and that produces some phenotype. If I reduce the level of notch by a factor of 2, again, I would expect less signal, and that would produce some phenotype. Right? But if I would reduce both notch and delta by a factor of 2, then I would expect an even less signal or a more severe phenotype. Right, but to get this kind of compensation, right, you would need to tune the system very hard. And in fact, it has been shown that this ratiometric dependence, right, is also maintained for other copies of notch and delta. So that you get a more severe phenotype if you have, let's say, bigger difference between copy numbers of delta and notch, okay, than lower ones. So this kind of ratiometric behavior is observed over several mutant phenotype. Mutant Drosophila. Okay, so, yeah.
Just on this thing before, so, as you say, when you reduce the utilization of delta, you expect to see less signal. Yeah, and so, why do you see even wider?
Right, so I'll talk about this in a second. So here's sort of a very simple model that we have for explaining this ratiometric behavior. Basically, what we say, okay, the boundary of the vein is determined by the crossing point between notch and delta. Okay, if I now reduce both the production rate of notch and delta by a factor of 2, then the crossing point between these two curves is essentially maintained in the same position. Okay. Now, you can ask, okay, what happens? What do you expect in the single heterozygous mutants, right? So for the single heterozygous notch, okay, you have less notch, but the same delta, the crossing, you would expect to get a broader vein, right? For the single heterozygous delta, that now depends a little bit on the relative levels of notch and delta, okay? So what we think that happens, that if delta goes below the level of notch here, then all the cells here become receiver cells, and you hardly have any notch signaling in the system. And in fact, it has been shown that if you don't have any notch signaling in the system, then you get this kind of broad and diffuse phenotype. So the explanation of this kind of heterozygous of delta, okay, according to our simplified model, is basically that there's hardly any restricting signal here because all the cells are in receiver mode. Okay? Yep. Right, so this is what, okay, so this is a null delta allele. Okay, I don't know exactly which one. My explanation for the higher sensitivity here is that we think that the level of delta, when you look at the heterozygous delta in this case, is such that there's no, all the cells here become receiver cells. Right, so there's hardly any delta signal, right? And then it has been shown that if you look at a null delta clone, right, you get these kinds of diffuse veins in that system.
So that's why the explanation that notch regulates delta. So the notch recognizes you already reduce the delta, and it's in the
hypothesis. Right, that could certainly be, and there has been evidence for feedbacks that are involved in the system, okay? But I think that the basic property of compensation cannot be explained based on feedbacks alone. So you could have some sort of aggravation of the phenotype due to the additional feedback in the system. Is this what you mean? Okay. It depends on the system that you're involved. Lateral inhibition, which I will talk a little bit about in the next few slides, there's actually no, Nick here has shown that there is no regulation of the level of delta. Or the expression of delta by notch signaling, but there could be post-transcriptional regulation of delta by notch signaling, okay, which actually has been shown by Francois Schweitzgut, who will be here next week. Okay, you know, one thing that you might worry about this mechanism is that this mechanism is very sensitive to noise, right? So if you now have noise in the production rate of notch and delta in each of the cells, right, then the crossing point may vary from one position to the other. So we did an analysis for the sensitivity to noise in this system. And basically, we wanted to compare two types of noise in the system, right? So one type of noise, which we call it the sort of intrinsic noise or uncorrelated noise. It assumes that the production rate of delta and notch can vary from cell to cell in an independent manner. Okay. The other type of noise that we looked at is type of noise where the production rate of delta and noise, okay, may vary from cell to cell, but this variation may be correlated due to some extrinsic factors. Okay, for example, if cell cycle affects the levels of production rate of notch and delta, you would expect both of them to be affected in a similar manner. Right. So then, okay. So now, if you simulate this kind of process with the two types of noise, you can see that actually, if you have intrinsic noise, okay, the system is pretty sensitive to this kind of uncorrelated noise. And again, that makes sense because we know that the relative level of notch and delta determine the crossing point. However, if you have an extrinsic noise where notch and delta are correlated, then the system is a lot more robust to this type of noise. And we can do the same thing. We can ask, okay, if we change the correlation of the correlation between noise in delta and notch, and we look at different amplitudes, how does it affect the standard deviation, for example, of that peak here? And indeed, you see that as you increase the noise correlation, you expect to get a more robust pattern. Now, it might be interesting to ask whether notch and delta production are some sort are regulated in some way so that they maintain a relative level, which is quite maintained or quite fixed. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, we did not analyze that, and it's certainly worthwhile. It looks just from the pictures, it looks very robust, right? Very well defined boundary. Certainly, I'm not suggesting that this is the only mechanism that would involve that. All right, so let's switch now to lateral inhibition. Again, we can ask, lateral inhibition is this kind of checkerboard-like pattern that I was showing in the beginning, and we can ask, how does cis inhibition, mutual inactivation, affects lateral inhibition? Yeah. Yep.
I said, given that you have done all the work to look for noise, what further interaction, if I let you be God, and then you could bring whatever interaction you wanted, what interaction would you put in to ensure that the strike move was much more precise? Because I have a guess, right? I mean, the words will guess.
You mean. Sharpness of the boundary. Well, there's actually two aspects to that, right? There's the sort of sharpness, right? How sharp the boundary or the precision of the boundary, and then you can ask, okay, what makes it kind of straight, right? So that it's a kind of a straight line, and you know, you could imagine that there are sort of mechanical forces that are involved in this process that would, you know, maintain a certain correlation length. Okay, N would help with maintaining the width of the boundary in some way. Is that what you were guessing as well? All right. Okay, so a little bit about lateral inhibition. The idea about lateral inhibition, how do you break the symmetry between neighboring cells? And basically, what you the model that has been proposed already quite a long time ago is that cells send inhibitory signals to each other, preventing them from differentiation. Now, this is not sufficient to generate a differentiation between the cells. You need an additional element, and that element is a feedback mechanism in which notch signaling in each cell downregulates delta in that cell. Okay, and that generates a kind of a bicellular positive feedback, which can amplify small differences between cells. Okay, and it turns out that you know, if you apply this kind of model on an array of cells with a little bit of noise, you can get a pattern, not necessarily like this, but this is one of the patterns that you can get. And the positive feedback, essentially, the idea is that if one cell expresses slightly more delta than the other, it downregulates the level of delta in the neighboring cell, which then removes the repression in delta in the first cell, and this way small differences can be amplified so that there's one winner and the cells around it are the losers. Okay, and One thing that you can ask is under what conditions, okay, what are the requirements for such a model? What are the requirements you need to get patterning in this case? Would it always pattern? And you can do a nice analysis for this, and you can show that, you know, one of the main requirements that you would need is that you would need that this feedback in which notch signaling downregulates delta has to be cooperative. Okay, and in fact, for a two-dimensional hexagonal array of cells, this cooperativity must be at least bigger than two. Okay, now the question that we ask ourselves: okay, what happens if you now add the cis inhibition into the lateral inhibition model? Okay, you now allow delta not only to activate notch in the neighboring cells, but also bind to notch in the same cell. Okay, and we can ask whether this kind of model affects the ability to pattern, or even the dynamics of patterning in this system. Okay, so the way you can treat that is that you can write a set of equations that include both the feedback and the cis inhibition, and you perform a linear stability analysis in this system. And this is what we did here. We basically changed the two parameters, main parameters in the system, the production rate of notch and the production rate of delta. Okay, and we ask, under what conditions do we get patterning? Okay. And what you see here is that if you have cooperative feedback, in this case, we took a feedback with a Hill coefficient of 3, okay, you get a pretty large region of your parameter space which support lateral inhibition patterning. Okay. However, if you look at a situation where you have no cooperativity, right, so all the feedback is linear, you essentially do not get any parameters that support the pattern. Okay, so what happens if you now introduce the cis inhibition? Yeah.
So in your experiment,
yes. That's right. Yep. With. That's not what?
You mean the limit is theoretical, it has to be over 2, right?
Right.
But you measured it as being
below 2, right. It was plus or minus 0.9, right? So you could say it could be below or it could be above, right? But anyway, it would be marginal for this kind of feedback, right? That's true also, right? We do not know. Well, we measured the Hill coefficient also for the full-length notch, okay, and notch reporter, and we basically see a similar non-cooperative or mildly cooperative response. Okay, but it doesn't mean that, as we say.
You know, the question, I guess one of the questions is, how important is the vision of black orientation in people, right? And so if you could say that the transactuation of not being cooperative.
Right.
Right,
but then somebody else would come and would say, okay, we're talking about cooperativity of not only the signaling process, but also of the feedback itself, which you would have to measure separately, right? So ideally, right, when we started this project, we figured out, okay, maybe the cooperativity, the trans-cooperativity is in the signaling system, okay, in the trans-activation, okay, and we didn't find it. Okay, it doesn't mean that there is no cooperativity in the feedback. What we suggest here, we say something somewhat weaker. Okay, we say basically, okay, we need this cooperativity, high Hill cooperativity, to get instability, to get patterning. Okay, but if you add the cis interaction, okay, then you can get patterning even if none of your regulatory processes is cooperative.
So that's basically why the
No, or it says that if you have cis inhibition, it doesn't. It's not important anymore for the system to be cooperative, right? It already introduces the cis interaction, this ultra-sensitive switch, and also already introduces the nonlinearity required for the instability of the system, right?
But so, you're saying if you have cis inhibition, you don't need to be cooperative.
Yes.
You
could say that. That's equivalently true. I agree. Yeah.
I don't fully understand here. Because your model and your parameter settings assume a constant uniform cell type at the beginning of pattern, right?
Right.
So if now all cells have much more notch than delta, it wouldn't work. And similarly, if all had much more delta than notch, it also wouldn't work. So this cell type has to be extremely close to a one-to-one, such that...
Well, you know, this one-to-one thing, right, is here. Okay? You see this this stripe? Right? This is where the nonlinearity is maximal. Okay?
Why would the one-to-one not follow the diagonal? I mean, if I take the numbers,
Not exactly. Okay, there are other parameters. What you want to ask is what are the steady state values, okay, of my equations, and in each term here, or in each set of parameters, and then ask, does this steady state value, the homogeneous steady state value, in this case, is it the case where a notch is close to delta or not? Okay. Now here's what I want to point out. Okay. What you say is that you would expect that, based on this cis inhibition, okay, you would expect that you would see an effect only very close to the transition point where a notch equals to delta. Okay. Now it's not. Now it depends on the exact parameters, the strengths of the cis interaction. In fact, there's a regime which is typically, you know, could be an order of magnitude, okay, below or above this point, where you still have nonlinearity. The nonlinearity is maximal right at the transition, but even away from the transition, you still have nonlinearity due to this term. Okay?
But I mean, if you don't have feedback, then a cell that at time part one could be a sender, could flip into a receiver, right? Because without feedback, a cell could go back and forth.
Well, but there is feedback here, right? There is feedback. This is a model that includes both feedback and cis inhibition.
Okay, feedback and no cooperative feedback.
But not cooperative feedback, okay? All right, the... Okay. I would just say that the other thing that you can ask about the system is whether the dynamics are changed due to the addition of cis inhibition. And what we can show is that if you compare the dynamics of two models, one with mutual inactivation and one without, you get a much faster dynamics with the mutual inactivation. This can be understood relatively simply in terms of the fact that you have that this cis inhibition is essentially an additional degradation term in your system, right? That is dependent on notch, but it's still a degradation term, so the dynamics are much faster in this system. And there was a nice paper by Nama Barkai, which also discussed this aspect of cis inhibition, making it the dynamics much faster. Okay, so the comparison here, okay, is that all the other parameters, the production rates and degradation rates, are all the same, and you just have the whether you have the additional term or do not have the additional term of cis interaction. Okay, we can discuss whether it's a fair comparison or not. All right. So just to summarize, mutual inactivation of notch and delta forces the cell to be either a sender or a receiver, but not both. And I hope to have convinced you that this switch can help facilitate patterning, either sharp boundary, explaining the heterozygous mutant behavior, we also shown that it's robust to correlated noise and to, not so robust to uncorrelated noise. And finally, with respect to lateral inhibition, you can get lateral inhibition in the absence of cooperative feedback, okay? And you can also, you will also get faster patterning dynamics with this inhibition. I didn't have time to discuss some of the other points, so that's okay. So I'd like just to thank the people that have been involved. This work was done here at Caltech, 2 hours from here, with Michael Elowitz. There are two graduate students that have been involved in this project, Amit and Lauren. Leah is a technician that has done a lot of the cell line work that I've shown you, and Michelle and Graham are also technicians that helped in the lab. And Jordi Garcia Halvo was involved, is from the Technical University of Barcelona, and he was involved in some of the modeling that I have discussed today. So thank you very much for your attention.
So regarding some lateral inhibition, having this mutual inactivation,
yep,
is a bit like having a positive feedback.
That's right. Yeah, so. We did not do the comparison of whether it's exactly the same as having let's say a transcriptional positive feedback. I don't know, maybe David Wensky done the comparison? No? Okay, so basically, why is it a positive feedback? If a cell receives a signal notch, it downregulates delta, right? If it downregulates delta, then it makes more notch available, right? So that's the kind of positive feedback that it involves, so in the system. Yeah. Yeah.
So one slide back, you have the time course in space. Oh, sorry, two slides back, my fault. The thing up there. And I suppose I, with or without mutual inactivation, are those figures very different? In space, the propagation.
Ah, the pattern itself?
Yeah.
Okay, that's an interesting thing, right? So. Well, you know, one thing that we observed is that if you do have cis inhibition, you can actually get patterns that you cannot get without cis inhibition. Okay, now I don't know if it if you can find a alternative. I don't know if you can find examples for that in a natural processes, but basically changing, for example, the strength of cis inhibition, okay, you can start getting a stable state, okay, in which two delta cells, high delta cells, are next to each other, okay, and even if you change it more, you can have even multiple deltas, high delta cells that are next to each other. And the reason that this is allowed in this system, right? Usually you would say, if you have two delta cells, right, that there's it's unstable because one of them would win, right? But the reason that this is allowed here is because you could have two deltas, high delta state, but since they have such a high delta and such a strong cis inhibition, they essentially shut their ears, if you want, shut their notch receptor from receiving a delta signal from their high neighbor. Right, so it's essentially, you have a sort of a half deaf cells that can sort of ignore the high delta cells next to them. So you can, in principle, get slightly different patterns. I do not know to tell you if this is relevant to any physiological.
In time, and I don't want to bring up Thomas' talk yesterday, but in time, this is the sort of steady state, right?
Yeah.
So in time, I suppose, my question is maybe it's worth looking at.
Ah, yeah, yeah. You mean in terms of what is the dynamics of patterning? How they sort of propagate out of a certain area? Yeah, that might be interesting. Yep.
So, I think the question in part of the field, which maybe it should have been questioned, has been how does this inhibition explain natural inhibition of vivo, or how much is it contributed in vivo?
Right.
And how does it distinguish, like Lawrence's question she was addressing, to distinguish this inhibition, which involves some inhibitory complex in the mechanical guide, from feedback, which involves some modification of delta in the mechanical guide?
Yeah. Well, the difficulty is, right. That's right. Yeah, well, I had a long discussion about this with Francois Schweif, both who's studying lateral inhibition. And you can think of certain experiments that involve clones in which you change the copy number of, let's say, delta or notch, and then look at the, on top of these copy number changes, prevent, let's say, transactivation through some additional processes. And you can think about sort of specific mutants that would make a difference between a picture of cis inhibition and a picture without cis inhibition. We can discuss this. It's slightly involved to discuss it here. Okay. But I think you can. Okay. Right. Not yet, at least. Not yet. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.